I love the album cover for Piano Man. It doesn't, I mean, it kind of looks like Prince, you know, doesn't it? Yeah. Right. Like the, and you know, almost has like a Jesus Christ Superstar. Oh. Is that what I'm thinking of? Or is it a Godspell? Maybe it's Godspell I'm thinking of. Like, just like the face, you know, just like him, you know, looking back at you kind of thing. It's kind of, it, I don't know. It's haunting in a weird way, but it's also, like you said, comforting.
It too. Looks like know. A ghost. It looks like a ghost. Yeah. And it was funny because I used to have the cassette. I had a cassette with the album cover on it, of course. And I remember my parents finding the cassette and this ghostly image. And they were like, "What kind of demonic music are you listening to? What is this?" And I'm like, and I'm thinking to myself, like, this is like the most like mainstream music you could probably listen to. This is wholesome, right?
Billy Joel's Piano Man turns 50 this week. What a better time to analyze the record as a document of history than on such a milestone anniversary? And who better to talk to me about it than my friend Jack? As an English professor, Jack is very familiar with using primary sources, including often overlooked ones like pop music records. He also is the person who introduced me to internet radio several years ago when we would hang out in his dorm room and email the DJ requests for Billy Joel songs. But first, Paul was a visitor to Strawberry Bank Museum in Portsmouth, New Hampshire this summer and stopped by my exhibit table. Before I knew it, he was telling me an incredible story about working as a roadie for the Bad Boys from Boston, Aerosmith, when they were first starting out. I had to have him walk this way back to the beginning of the story so I could record it and let you all have a listen.
They were all free back then, the concerts, and we'd get down to the Cambridge concerts and you would see different people, Graham Nash, people from Four Way Street, you know. It was amazing, some of the people that you would see, Arlo Guthrie, and that's what we would do. I lived in Natick at the time. There would be three or four of us that would ride our bicycles out to Cambridge, to the Cambridge Common. We'd find a side street, lock our bikes up, and go enjoy ourselves for the day, and then ride our bikes back home.
What an incredible time, because that was like, I mean, if we were to say rock and roll started mid-50s,
right,
you know, started with, you know, put a mark there, we're talking only, that's a solid 20 years, 15, 20 years of rock and roll, and yet you're still being able to access these artists, you know, because nowadays if you go to a rock concert with a name even half as big as some of the ones you just mentioned, you're just dropping at least $60 for nosebleed seats in the back of some huge stadium.
God, yeah. I mean, I went and saw Elvis Costello, 2 months ago? He was at the MGM.
Yeah.
And MGM Fenway. He played there. And the money I spent on that concert, I probably could have gone to 10 concerts.
Right, yeah.
At that price.
Even with inflation. It's like you'd still be... And so if you don't mind just repeating that story about Aerosmith, because that was cool. I think a lot of people don't know, maybe it's general knowledge, their connection to Boston, that they're the Bad Boys of Boston, basically.
Well, they used to play in, they had this barn in South Natick that they used to rent. It was like, it was an old Dover rug store back then. I'm talking in the early 70s. And we were kids, we used to play Frisbee in a park out there. And they come out one time and asked us, said, "Look, can you move some equipment for us?" So we did. We moved them to Framingham North High School, and they played out there. And then they played at, I think, the Surrey Lounge in Ashland and another place. And we went out and we helped them move their equipment. And then they started getting popular. Everybody was there. The schools were packed. The bars were packed. They got a gig at Boston College, and we went to help them. When we got there, we were told we couldn't help them because it was union work.
And so, like, the roadies at Boston College, they had to do it.
They did all the work, and we were never used again. But when they would come by and see, they'd still wave and talk to us.
So they were nice guys.
Yeah, all of them. Yeah, they were nice to us. You know, like, they very friendly, very open. They weren't malicious anyways.
Yeah.
They were very down to earth.
That's really refreshing to hear, because almost by definition, when you hear the term, you know, people will use the word rock star kind of derogatory, like, right. Oh, that guy's acting like a rock star. Like, and when I hear the word rock star, Steven Tyler tends to come to mind immediately.
Right.
But I know that he does live in New Hampshire, at least some of the time, out in Sunapee. I don't know his exact address for people to harass him, but and people say for the most part, he's just pretty easygoing guy. He's not.
Yeah, they're down to earth. I think, you know, being a rock star, you got to guide yourself because there's so many crazy people.
Right.
But you are what you are. If you stay natural, you're natural.
Right.
And I think that's what they were. Just good-hearted people.
Do you think that that's kind of the product of that time period in rock and roll history? Because they were doing, a lot of those groups were I know rock and roll had been around for a little while, but they were doing new things with rock that hadn't really been done. You know, it was heavier stuff.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if they probably had to rely on, you know, the kindness of strangers to help them out along the way. They weren't really, it hadn't established itself the way that the next decade. So you think of the 80s, like the metal bands and the hair metal guys and stuff like that. That's when you get those attitudes of.
I bet you 90% of the bands that ever started out had to start out that way.
Yeah.
Just like they did. And it's, some of them lose their personality, some of them don't.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them become divas. And some of them don't.
Right.
You know, it's just a person. It's what you are inside.
Yeah. I guess it does come down to that. I got to think that it's like because they were the first of that kind of sound, that there was no room for them to have that diva, you know. And then when the groups later on in the 80s, they already started on that level of like, I want to be in a rock band so I can get girls and party all night and do all these things where, like you said, these other guys in the 70s, they worked from the bottom up. Like they had to work really, really hard.
Had just to earn it.
Yeah, because there wasn't an apparatus in place for them to just quickly, you know, there's no MTV, so they couldn't just show up and.
There were no CDs.
Yeah.
You know, I think 8-tracks were the biggest thing back then.
Right.
You know, and that was, it's either that or vinyl. And cassettes were probably just starting to kick in.
Right.
You know, and becoming what they were, which was a better sound. But, you know, you didn't have the computers, all the stuff that you have nowadays.
Right.
So you had to work harder.
They did. And they knew that what they were working with had its limits. And so they had to overcome them as much as possible. And
it's funny because when you see Aerosmith, the Beatles, bands like that, Led Zeppelin, that they're going to be famous for another 50 years. People are going to be 200 years away from these groups and still hear their music and go, wow, they were good.
Yeah. You know? I think about that all the time. Like rock and roll, you know, nothing against modern day rock and roll artists. Like I can't name any bands that I think are going to last as long as. And it has to do with that time period because it was so revolutionary what they were up to in the late 60s, early 70s, that it's like that's the trajectory they went on. I don't know what you could do with rock and roll now to make yourself stand out. It's like almost it's all been done, you know?
And it's funny when we think that way, there's another band that pops up with a new idea.
Yeah, and hopefully it's a good one because I know they tried some stuff, you know, there's groups that tried to integrate, you know, like orchestra sounds and
techno
it's
stuff.
Yeah, and it's crossing like, over a lot with rap,
yeah,
which Aerosmith did, but it wasn't really there. That was just because their records, you know, the rappers were using their records. They liked the beat to walk this way, and that's what Run DMC did. And then in the MTV age, they're like, well, the two of you need to get together because both your kinds of music are getting popular. So we want to cash in as much as possible.
You look what like guys like Chuck Berry were doing in the 50s and Otis Redding and how that still was popular in the 80s,
mm-hmm.
you know, still developing that kind of sound.
Yeah. I saw the Beach Boys a few weeks ago. I mean, it's not really the Beach Boys anymore. It's a couple guys that were in the band and a bunch of other guys. But it's like they they still sometimes write newer songs. They actually covered a Ramones song, which I thought was pretty cool, that they went full circle and, you know, a band that was inspired by them is now, you know, playing their songs. But it was like the crowd, you know, it skewed older, of course. People that grew up listening to the Beach Boys were in attendance, but everybody was enjoying the sounds of the 60s. You know, music that came out, you know, in the early to mid 60s was still being danced to and cheered.
It's like me growing up, I used to love the Bee Gees when they were in the 60s. And when I heard them change their music style over to Staying Alive, it was totally different from what they were. And I was like, I don't know if this is going to work. And look how popular it was.
Right.
But I thought, personally, the Bee Gees were better back then than they were.
As a more straight up, you know, rock group rather than disco stuff. And it's always funny when you discover that kind of thing about a band. Like a band becomes popular for one particular either song or style of music. And then you're like, oh, like Fleetwood Mac.
Right.
So, like, Mick Fleetwood's early stuff is pretty straight-up rock and roll.
Right.
And then I don't even really know how you would describe Fleetwood Mac other than just kind of, like, progressive rock, I guess, or blues, fusion. It's hard to label them necessarily, but that's a group that's been through a lot of different...
It's even got a twang of folk in it.
Yeah.
With the ballads that the girls do.
Right.
And then,
you know, I like how Fleetwood Mac is almost kind of like an organization that people join from, you know, they come and go. Like Lindsey Buckingham has like been in the band sometimes and other times he's not. And he has kind of like a more straight up rock and roll sound. Like whenever I think of Summer Vacation, I always think of the movie National Lampoon's Vacation with his song at the beginning, Holiday Road. And found out, I'm like, oh, that's the guy from Fleetwood Mac? I had no idea. It doesn't sound like one of their songs at all.
I think that was the biggest shame about Fleetwood Mac is that they messed around with each other too much and it imploded. All those relationships imploded them and it tore them all apart because of it. But their music... Some of their music will last forever.
Yeah, it will. I've only kind of recently gotten more into them. Like I wasn't like super into them for a while, and then my wife kept playing a lot of like their CDs and stuff. And I'm like, oh wait, I like these because they're going back to where we started with. They're authentic. It seems like it's coming from the artist, not from a producer or something saying, now you got to do this. It's like they were behind it.
Oh, they definitely did it their way.
I love having this conversation that incorporates technology so much. And for those of you listening, because you can't see it, behind us is a 18th century cooper showing his craft, which is like the oldest trade. You know, it's been around for centuries. And here we are with microphones talking about rock and roll and how... doing a podcast. But Paul, thanks for so much for stopping by and let me put this down on my show, and I hope that the listeners enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed hearing it.
Rock and roll was in an interesting spot in the early 70s, as it was easily on its third generation of bands and fans already, but was being pushed and pulled into several different directions, not unlike American society itself, honestly. Aerosmith's rapid rise to prominence is evidence of many listeners favoring a harder, louder sound than what had come before and other contemporary options. Billy Joel was and is a contemporary of Aerosmith and has produced nearly every style of rock and roll in his more than 50-year career, but it's his second album that gave him the title The Piano Man. The album represents the other side of the spectrum of listening options of the early 1970s from Aerosmith, a softer rock and roll. Looking and listening closely to the record Piano Man, especially five decades later, reveals a musician trying very hard to find his voice and claim a noteworthy piece of the pop music world. Here's Jack and I deciding what else this album can tell us about Billy Joel himself and the world of 1973.
joined today by Jack, Professor Jack. He is a college instructor, a English instructor, but more than all of that, he's a good friend of mine. I've known Jack since our years going to school on the shores of Lake Ontario in New York. Jack, this is a long time coming. We've been meant to do this for years. So welcome to the Everything is a Primary Source podcast.
Thanks a lot, Eric. I appreciate that.
You were the one that you introduced me to internet radio. I think before really podcasting took off, I remember hanging out in your dorm room and you had your internet radio station on. And I was just kind of like amazed that those weren't more well known or more widely used back then, because I'm like, well, this is brilliant. You don't have to worry about trying to tune into the station. You just have to have good internet hookup. You know, why isn't everybody doing this? And now 20 years later, everybody is doing it. And you know, that was like before podcasting, but what got you into internet radio? And I should also say you were the first person to introduce me to Facebook too. I never knew about Facebook until you started using it.
Yeah. You know, and there's no risk at this point of like dating ourselves. So I think one of the nice things about that time period is that these things seemed relatively new, even though I think by the time, you know, I was talking to you about it, you know, Facebook had been around at least for a couple of years. It's hard to remember exactly how I came across internet radio outside of the fact that what I was really lamenting at the time was radio stations that had, disc jockeys, you know, personalities, people whose voices you would recognize. And it was at that point that I said, oh, gosh, you know, there must be, somewhere out there still where you can see some of that. And this is, you know, we're talking about, you know, the early 2000s, you know,
2005,
right,
six,
right. There. So, yeah. You know, they still had people, playing records, but not, you know, not in the same way, you know, everything by the time, you know, we're listening to that, it's all pretty much computerized, I think. What was nice about the, internet radio is that you could at the time anyways, chat live with the DJs who were broadcasting, over the internet and make requests. You know, and so that was part of the fun is, you know, it said, oh, you know, my friends, you know, are coming over. We're studying for finals. You know, could you send us, you know, play us a song or whatever, give us some motivation or something like that. And they would call out our names, I remember.
Yeah, I think that was the fun of it. And actually to tie it in what we're talking about today, it's almost like the song Piano Man by Billy Joel, where it's like, but instead it's a computer man. Like, give us a song, computer That's man. Right. That's right. I will play it tonight.
Yeah.
But... It's I remember hanging out with you and you requested some Billy Joel while we were in that, and it's like that exhilaration that you're just saying, it's like it's exhilarating, especially back then in those that first like 10-20 years of the internet, to have that kind of like instant gratification where you're like, I sent somebody a message. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't even know where they are. They could be hundreds of miles away, they could be right next door, but they responded to me and they're acknowledging me. And that's I'll never forget, like in the early days of online chatting, and I'm talking like mid-90s, Michael Jackson and MTV, they had a special thing where Michael Jackson was going to be in a chat room and you could send him questions. And my friend, I didn't have internet at my house, but my friend had internet at his house, and we were all excited for it. I'm like, this will be no trouble at all. We'll talk to him. You know, we'll be like maybe 10 other people. You know, we had no idea like the scope of internet stuff. And it's like, you know, that might be why there's not more internet radio, because it's just so wide, you know, so huge that there was, you know, like you said, like, how do you break into, you know, that? And the same thing goes with podcasts. And there's just so many podcasts out there that, it all gets just kind of lost in the minutia. But Jack is, and the reason why I asked you to talk to me about this album, Piano Man by Billy Joel, you are probably, of all my friends, the most knowledgeable about Billy Joel. You seem to, you love the artist and his entire, you celebrate his entire catalog, to borrow from Office Space. What is it about Billy Joel that you've loved all these years?
Wow, that's a great question. I think part of what there are a couple of things. I think that, you know, the idea about talking about that album as a primary source kind of is part of the equation, because certain artists, certain television programs or certain other forms of media, you know, sometimes they tie you to a particular place. And mm-hmm. when and because, you know, Billy Joel is kind of connected to New York City, in that kind of way, I think when I left for college, it was one of those artists that I think got me through some moments of homesickness, not to mention the idea that, at one point, I think there was something really interesting about the lyrics for me. And so I remember, trying to learn how to write lyrics myself. I said, well, gosh, maybe, I don't know how to play an instrument, but maybe I can learn how to write song lyrics or something like that, and so I would like practice, over melodies that I knew, and Billy Joel's would be one of those examples. But that's just part of it. I think nowadays when I kind of look back on it, I think it is sort of, his work is this sort of celebration of what I guess you might call the banality of life, the ordinariness of life. And that Piano Man album, since it's coming up on the 50th anniversary of that release, I think what's kind of interesting is that it sort of sets or creates this space for people to think about the everyday and the ordinary. And that's not to say that, that may not have been the case before. But there's something very, I don't want to say folksy, but, there's not a lot of, there's not a lot of pomp and circumstance to Billy Joel, in fact, it's probably not even cool. It probably never was cool, to be interested in his music. But I think that's part of the appreciation is that, it's, if you're going to conceptualize what pop music is, even if you don't like pop music, even if you fashion yourself as someone who likes avant-garde music or something indie, you can't have that without its contrast, And so there has to be sort of an appreciation of that.
Well, that's actually a really great way of where Billy Joel steps in and has always stepped in pop music is, he is probably the first one to acknowledge the other forms of, music out there that maybe he's not really competing with it, but is just kind of like maybe taking from some of it or not, because I'm thinking about, Still Rock and Roll to Me, which came out later, a couple, in the 80s, where he just kind of like lists off all the different kinds of, musical genres that have kind of, tapered off in different directions from the original form. And, that's like right up there with Huey Lewis singing the same thing, basically in the same time with, Heart of Rock and Roll. And then, Billy Joel, of course, goes on to doing We Didn't Start the Fire, where it's, it's not about music specifically, but so he's almost like the observer, like he's the one that he's omnipresent. He's always there. Madison Square Garden. He is always there, literally. He's just kind of like, and this is an early album for him, but it's aptly named. He's the Piano Man. And it's almost like the title song, you know, he's widened the lounge that he's playing in into being like New York, into the country, maybe the world. You know, he was one of the first artists to play in Moscow, you know, during the, you know, was that before or after the Berlin Wall fell? Maybe right after?
I think that probably the 87 tour.
Oh, okay. So, yeah. So even before, you know, that was a big deal. And so he's like rock and roll ambassador in a way, pop music ambassador. Welcome. And the way that this program works is we dissect pop culture through a form, just the same way that something would be in a museum. You know, so if a museum is entering in an artifact to be on display or to learn from in some way, they would as much as possible answer the questions that we're about to for that artifact to try to see what it tells about the time and place in the society that produced it. And so we're doing the exact same thing here with music. And I think we already covered pretty well the status in society and the role. I mean, he's a self-proclaimed piano man. He is the character that he creates in that particular song that he chose. And I think that lends really nicely to the first question actually on the list, what is the material it's made from? And how is it made? So do you think that first of all, are we in agreement that Piano Man, the song, is him, right? I mean, he wrote all the songs for the album. So that's, he's speaking, you know, kind of, he's putting himself in that position. Does that narrative go the rest of the songs, would you say?
That's my impression. You know, I gave it another listen, and my sense is that, you know, it's pretty, it really is forwarding this idea of the autobiographical, you know, which goes in hand with, you know, the era, right, of that we're talking about, the singer-songwriter.
Yeah.
But it's strange because, you know, the initial like Rolling Stone reviews of this album kind of criticized Billy Joel for avoiding talking about himself and kind of offering something like, you know, these representations of ordinary people, but without a lot of depth, almost caricatures of people. But I, you know, I'm not sure I necessarily agree with that initial take, maybe because, you know, we're talking about this 50 years later, and we're not talking about an unknown, right? And so, you know, when you have a sense of the artist's background, you know, things seem to make a little bit more sense when you look back at the album. So I would say, yeah, you're looking at a pretty good autobiographical piece, if not a list of or a sense of this person's thinking, his ideas that sort of drive his music.
Yeah. It's, you know, so if he's the, you know, he's the songwriter for all these songs, and recording them. And of course they have piano, you know, he's playing the piano and, you know, the rest of the music is by, other artists in the studio. I don't know. What does all this tell you about that era of this very personalized, you know, cause like if I turn on TV at the same time period, I'd be watching, I believe it's the era of like All in the Family. It would be the era of other programs where it's more realistic. It's a lot more intimate. It's a lot more like, you know, slice of life kind of thing. But it's still comical at the same time. It's still almost, it's, you know, like Archie Bunker is a, you know, plenty of people could relate to having a dad like that in that era, but he's also a caricature. You know, he's not really meant to be much more than that. So this album is almost like, if I'm not mistaken, it seems consistent with the time period of, you know, especially in the direction that pop music was going. This is like, it's not 100% opening up his soul to everybody, but it's getting there.
Yeah. You know, and when I was thinking about that question, you know, what is this album made of, you know, and it's certainly all these ideas that you're talking about are true. And I like the comparison to, you know, a television program, but I think what marks this particular example is the fact that, you know, because we have the benefit of hindsight, you know, half a century later, you know, one of the things that it can remind us of is, you know, what I guess some people have called sort of like the materiality of music, like this album, like so many others in, at the time, were physical objects that you had to acquire, and they had to be made. I think I'm trying to remember the writer's name. There's a book called Decomposed. And it's a book that kind of gives, talks about this, you know, in much more detail, of course, but it's called The Political Ecology of Music. And one of the things they remind everybody is the kinds of natural resources that go into making albums in the second half of the 20th century. And one of those, of course, is, you know, thinking about it in terms of like the oil that's right. needed, right? And so we don't think about it that way. Just like when we think about Archie Bunker, we don't think about television sets, right? But when you think about what these programs made possible, what music makes possible, we would be remiss if we forget the fact that, you know, they are asking us to do things like purchasing objects and acquiring them. And so I think what you start to see at this moment is this sort of like not only the individual artist's biography being sort of center stage, but in a certain way, the listener also becomes center stage. Like, you're also being asked to listen to my music, to consume the music, to identify with the music, and perhaps, you know, perhaps move some units.
Well, I wonder if this is also the same time period in which, like, the kind of like the another stereotype or another caricature, but like the record store snob was born, you know, like kind of, you know, like the character in High Fidelity, where it's like, well, like there's a gatekeeperism, like, well, you can't come into the store until you prove to me that you're going to cherish this piece of vinyl like it's gold, you know, and even if it's not a gold record, you know, it's like, you can tell me that. And it's that kind of, it still exists. I think it's almost cyclical. It's like whenever there's a kind of, like you said, physical thing to hold, there's going to be people who become aficionados, and, you know, they're not going to be snobby to the point where they, like, I only listen to one kind of music, but they want like the best of everything. Like, they only want to celebrate and be interested in what's the best. And I'd be curious if, you know, 'cause obviously there's been record stores since there's been records, but I'm curious if this would also be the same time in which, you know, that classic image of, you know, girls coming in with their poodle skirts and guys like, hey, what's the next hop record? And, you know, that, like, it becomes much more of a, almost like a collector's center when you go into a music store in 1973 in that era of like, I am willing to be but I'm a consumer. Not only in that I'm consuming this, but I'm a consumer in that I'm very particular about where I separate my money, you know, for this thing. I want to make sure I'm getting a quality album and not just, you know, 'cause that's another thing too. It's an album. It's not a 45. It's not just a single, you know, you're buying a full album. That's a great term for what we're dealing with here. In a couple hours, I'm going to be talking to another guest about a record that was made 10 years earlier in 1963. And in that era, they made albums, but they weren't like where they became by Piano Man. They weren't, it was basically just like, let's find a bunch of songs that are similar in theme, slap them together into one record, and then you have like thematic. And it was actually the Beach Boys who we saw together, if you remember, that fateful trip where I got like a sunburn in my eye because we had to stay we had to stay in the same spot. It was a free concert in Niagara Falls. We had to stay in the same spot, and the sun was like setting right down the line of a building, so it wasn't, I was like, anyway. But of all the heavenly objects to get burned by during a Beach Boys concert, it would be the sun. It was Pet Sounds, basically, by, you know, that basically revolutionized the album. Like, instead of just taking a bunch of songs, and because the Beach Boys were doing it too. Mm-hmm. You know, here's a bunch of songs about cars, make a car album. You know, here's a bunch of songs about surfing, make a surfing album. Mm-hmm. By 73, because of that revolution that had taken place, you know, led by the Beach Boys and followed by other rock and roll groups, Billy Joel is not just like, here's a bunch of songs about pianos. You know, this one's like Tickling the Ivory and, you know, right. I like pianos. This, you know, it's like, this is like, it's a concept. Here's my bigger message. And that translates to fans who are not listening thematically either. Cause that would be kind of annoying to be like, I want to listen to an album. Here's 20 songs in a row of, you know, car songs, you know, that one.
Sure.
It's like, I would rather listen to an album and have it tell some kind of story. Or make me think about it and want to listen to it again.
Yeah.
You know, listening with another part of my brain, if I could. I don't know if that seems like I'm off the deep end or if we're kind of discovering something about the early 70s that way.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure, you know, media historians probably have a much, you know, richer context about, you know, the importance, let's say, of the radio station in doing things like promoting an album. You know, what's fascinating about Piano Man is that it's one of these cultural artifacts, if you will, that... most people might be surprised, you know, almost, you know, almost wasn't, right? I mean, it had come out in late 1973 and pretty much didn't appear on the charts until the following spring. I learned this too, and kind of reading a little bit about this, that there was something like a timetable for artists when they put out a new album. And, you know, if it wasn't getting any airplay or if it wasn't being purchased in its initial printing, you know, there was a term for it. It was like the term was stiff. Right, that is, an artist would be referred to as a stiff, or the album itself would be referred to as a stiff, and that is something I came across in reading Keith Yates's memoir, and Keith Yates is an audio engineer of some type. That wrote this piece, I guess, a long time ago, but recently kind of went back and reflected on this again. And that was the way that he and his friend in college, they were community college students in Fresno, and they were working, as far as I can tell, in the campus newspaper called The Rampage. And he was cleaning out his boxes, because as a music critic back in the day, you would get promo copies, like promotional mm-hmm. copies of albums, and he would just collect these at his house, and he just writes about how he collected boxes and boxes of these things. And one day is clearing all of that out and sees this strange cover, you know, the one that we're talking about here, and decides to play the Piano Man album. Falls in love with the album, shows it to his friend, and he writes about this story about how they wage this long campaign to try and get this artist recognized and noticed. And they go through the local promotions desk at Columbia Records in California that doesn't want to have anything to do with Billy Joel at that point, because he'd already been the album had been out for about 3 or 4 months, and apparently that was old news, and they had no money to go back and promote something that came out and didn't go anywhere. And so then it was like a hunt for finding old copies, any copies that were left over that they could then try and get played on the radio. And so they tell this story about how they would encounter people at local radio stations because they were working part-time there and tried to get the album played. DJs don't want to have anything to do with it either, because it's, again, old, you know, 3-4 months. And anyway, the story kind of culminates, and it's a really interesting memoir, but if you take a look at this story, what's fascinating is that they take the surviving copies of the Piano Man album and they start playing it at the local record store, and they end up setting up a petition and getting local people to try and get copies of the Piano Man album, which at this point, you know, Columbia Records is not going to be producing any more of. And, you know, it goes on to tell this story about how, because of that campaign, they end up getting Billy Joel's record played on a local radio station that had a big audience. As you can imagine, this gets to Columbia Records, and all of a sudden there's an interest once again in Billy Joel's album. So according to Yates, anyways, you know, he and his friend, you know, wage this campaign and kind of save Piano Man from the dustbin of history.
Was Billy Joel aware of this while it was happening, or has he learned of it afterwards, of this campaign to basically bring him back to popularity?
That's a good question. I'm not sure, but the producer of the Piano Man album, Michael Stewart, was aware, because, you know, these are all people, as far as I can tell from the story, that knew each other. And this is, of course, you'd have to sort of have a sense of what the climate was like in California, I suppose, in the early 1970s, to sort of know, you know, how people might have known each other, I suppose. I'm not sure to what extent Billy Joel's aware of it, other than to say most likely he was aware that the album
started to sell better.
And then
maybe he's learning of it just now by listening to this podcast. He's like,
I'm sure. it's kind of a neat story. If you're able to find it, if you want, I can give you the title. It's
go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. It's called, The Time a Stiff Caught Fire, and it's, by Keith Yates. And it's a really interesting read, because you kind of get a sense of what it's like to be on the ground floor of something like that.
And I'm glad that you actually brought up, I mean, that was an incredible story. Thank you for sharing that. But also the terminology stiff record, because there was later in the 70s, there was a record company out of England called that. And it was like, they produced mostly like punk and new wave stuff. Mm-hmm. And so it's almost like they were using the industry terminology you know, on purpose to kind of right. like, yeah, you know, it's like loser records basically. Like, you know, nobody's going to want to listen to us anyway, but, sure. you know, or, you know, kind of like under promise and over deliver mentality of,
yeah,
you know, this album's no good. But I mean, that was the whole mentality of that particular movement, was to upend the entire system and mm-hmm. just do your own thing. And whatever happens, yeah. happens. If it becomes embraced, then great. If not, whatever, you know, you just got to do your own thing. And perhaps that was, you know, maybe Billy Joel himself was a little bit ahead of that. You know, I think when an artist makes a record, I would hope that they do so hoping that it will speak to people, it'll resonate with them, they'll enjoy it, they'll listen to it, they'll ask for those songs in concert. That, but it wasn't, so you're not saying it was like 5 years later or 10 years later, it was like just a few months later after the album debuted that people started latching onto it a bit more.
Well, what ends up happening is that the album becomes the demand becomes enough for them to continue the run of printing new ones because it was starting to get airplay. Mm-hmm. And by spring of the following year, so the album's released in the fall of 73, in spring of 74, it finally makes the charts. And I think gets as high as 27. Which for an album, you know, to do that 3 or 4 months after being released, you know, that's something to note. And that just goes to show you the power that individual people had in, you know, mobilizing themselves and local record stores, local radio stations to ask for, mm-hmm. you know, and demand a particular artist, you know, where it doesn't seem like that's what you have today, certainly. So the whole thing is kind of different.
It's an odd story. It's one where, because usually, and I think even before this album and definitely afterwards, usually it's the other way around, where like they'll start releasing singles, you know, to kind of appetize the listening audience, and then the album, you know, as we say now, drops. You know, it shows up, and people go and buy it. Where this seems to go in reverse order than that. I love what you say about the idea of the individual parties being involved. And it says something also about that time period that, like, if I had to go to a radio station, I wouldn't even know where to start. Like, I know where they are, kind of, you know, but a lot of times the physical station is totally off the grid. You know, and it's not like you just go to their door and knock on it. If you send a letter in the mail, I'm sure it just gets full of, you know, all their other mail that they get. Yeah. It's just like, they're almost on like a high tower that we can't reach nowadays. And maybe I'm not, you know, in big markets like New York City, they are in big skyscrapers. So it's not like you can just go to them like, yeah, I do you have any of that Billy Joel? Like, could you, you know? And I don't even know if they do, like, in a modern era, like the request lines like they used to. You know, we were talking about earlier, the internet radio kind of took over that job. So it says something about the time period. I was actually talking to a gentleman, and maybe I'll air his story as a short before this episode. And so I'll have to delete this right now. I was talking to a gentleman last week as one of my podcast karaoke guests, and he said he's from Natick, Mass, which is outside of Boston. And he told a story about one time around the same time period, like early 70s, 1973, probably. He was playing Frisbee with his friends in the park, and all of a sudden, like, Aerosmith just showed up. And, you know, they had a van because they asked because they were teenagers, and they're like, hey, could you guys help us load up load some equipment into this high school gym that they were playing that night. And they said, sure. And then from that point on, for the next few months, they were basically their unofficial roadies for Aerosmith, because wow, that's the kinds of shows that they were doing. And I always feel like the punk scene from a couple years later tries to make the claim of being the DIY, you know, yeah, real grassroots kind of music form, which they were, but other kinds of music were doing it too. You know, it's like, and you know, it's like Billy Joel and his fans were doing the same kind of, you know, really pounding the pavement kind of work. This guy was, you know, Aerosmith just plucked some kids out of the field, mm-hmm, you know, to do, you know, their roadie stuff. And I'm sure there's countless stories like that of very raw and organic, you know, this is, because that era was definitely, they were receiving the torch of rock and roll from the first generation, mm-hmm, you know, because that, like the Beatles were done by 70. You know, the Stones were kind of older, you know, the Beach Boys were on to making concept albums. It wasn't the same rock and roll as the 50s and the 60s produced. Right. This was a new generation making their music, and the way that they were going about it might not have, it didn't come out the same way and it didn't look the same way, but it had a lot of the same elements of those early rockers, for certain. I think just by our conversation, we've covered a lot of that first tier of questions, mm-hmm, you know, the role in society, who made it, how'd they make it. I think we even just by, you know, your discussion about the idea of a stiff record, you know, why they made it, because, you know, there is a gap from his first album to this one of about 3 years or, mm-hmm, 2 years. But you know, that propelling of an artist, okay, you need to make new music and you need to put it out there. You need to put it in album form. That covers why they made it. It's all part of it. I think it's interesting that it was recorded in California. You were saying at the beginning of this that Billy Joel to you is New York music, that he is, yeah, one of those, like if you were to make a soundtrack of New York that's, you know, piped in through all the streets as you're going around.
Yeah.
I think Billy Joel would, you know, he'd be definitely there for like the commute, maybe not the commute, but like lunchtime, maybe. But what do you make of that? That he recorded in L.A., not New York. Do you think that influenced it at all?
Oh yeah, I mean, I think his name is Hank Bartowitz, who wrote a biography a number of years ago. Anyway, ended up writing kind of like an insert for the Library of Congress, which had included Piano Man in the National Registry a couple of years ago. And in that story, he kind of talks about Piano Man as an album coming to fruition in large part because of the failure of the previous album that had been put out. And the talks about this initial album that Billy Joel puts together, and you know, at that time, and I guess you have to know something about how music is or was recorded as far as the specifics, you know, and so I don't know any about that stuff in particular, outside of the fact that, you know, individual instruments were recorded separately and then mixed together. Mm-hmm. From that's sort of like my layperson's understanding of it, right? Anyway, the final copy of the thing is sped up to the point where the music and the vocals are very high pitched, you know, and so it sounded terrible. Billy Joel hated it, or whatever, and there's this whole story about him having a party, inviting everybody to listen, and getting really upset and throwing the album across the room. This is all, you know, in the National Registry's info for Piano Man. But it's interesting because normally this would kind of signal the end, right? Because the radio stations were not going to play it, and then that's you know, kind of the point. Folks who own the record company that put out that album called Cold Spring Harbor, which is in New York,
Long Island. Yeah.
Right. You know, they decide they're going to try to, you know, make up some of the money that they spent creating the album. So they send Billy out on these tours, at one point sending him to Puerto Rico at this, huge music festival, where apparently does really well. People really loved his music. And he's an unknown at this time, at this point. Anyway, that original contract was for, I guess, 9 subsequent albums. You know, so he had signed all the rights and all of that, you know, for the rest of his career, I guess. So that was a big issue. And, you know, moves back to New York at the time, and is then, you know, trying to figure out how to recover from this failed album, you know, and so moves with his young family back to Los Angeles to try and you know, work on his music career. And in the meantime, gets a job at the Executive Lounge, which serves as kind of like the basis for Piano Man, as it
turns out. It's kind of funny because up until like moments ago when you said that, whenever I heard that song on the radio or whatever, I'd always picture a Manhattan lounge, you know, somewhere in New York City. I pictured that whole scene playing out, and I don't know if it changes things for me now of, you know, because LA has such a different feel to it. You know, now in my head, I'm going to see like mid-century, very angular, you know, like those like space age looking shapes to everything. So, like he's like in the lounge at LAX, like playing,
The album's funny in some ways because, you know, you see like elements of what I guess Billy Joel imagined country music was, you know? And so you see some of the instrumentals kind of play out that way. It's kind of an interesting.
I guess you could say in a way in that era of country music was like the outlaw country. Country really hadn't defined itself, you know? Yeah. It was still country had gotten a huge, like just all the different other kinds of music that had shown up in the rock and roll age is kind of, because like rock and roll has some, the early rock and roll has deep roots with country music and then goes off in its own direction. And then by the early 70s, they've kind of refound each other again, you know, artists like Willie Nelson and Waylon Jennings and, you know, Johnny Cash was part of that, you know, Hank Williams Jr., like the outlaw country kind of thing. And, you know, Ray Charles was doing country music, so it's like folk music, but I don't know. Did Billy Joel put in like a little cowboy hat and saloon music? Like,
I mean, if you listen to the opening track of that album called Traveling Prayer, it is an interesting attempt at this very thing because that song ends up getting covered by Dolly Parton. So if you ever have time, listen to Billy Joel and Dolly Parton's Traveling Prayer. Because they're very, very similar, very interesting. But it almost becomes a parody of itself, right? You have things like The Ballad of Billy the Kid, right? Mm-hmm. Which, as he's pointed out in subsequent interviews, you know, is not even historically accurate. but it didn't have to be. Not that it was intending to be parody necessarily, but the sound, right? The genre of can I do like a something that sounds like it would be a score, a movie score for a Western
That's movie. That's very forward thinking and very and I think it kind of answers the next question: who's the intended audience? It sounds like he was trying to find his audience. He probably was recognizing what we said earlier, that, you know, the music listeners of that era Some were the same, like the older, mm-hmm. you know, adults were the ones who grew up with the early rock and roll mm-hmm. in the '50s. And the other media reflects that. I mean, this is the same, it comes out, this was recorded a month after American Graffiti came out. So American Graffiti came out in August of 73. Billy Joel records this in September of 73. And I guess in some sense, it's almost for the same, you know, mature audience who's now being reflective about the last right. 30 years or so, 30, 40 years, and what it means to them. And so, you know, by kind of pulling from, I mean, the groups that he was touring with at this time were also pretty good menagerie of artists. Yeah. It wasn't a specific style of music that he was necessarily surrounded by. Right. And performing in front of live audiences in that era, it was still like you found some weird pairings for sure. If you, yeah. you know, I remember, so I'm big on another New York group, the Ramones. And mm-hmm. when they were starting out, they were paired up with, like, they played a show with Toto once, mm-hmm. Which doesn't really go with, you know, they toured with Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, which is a little bit closer, but not, wow. you know, and they released a singles album with him, and they're not quite the same music, but you know, they shared an audience of like, yeah, like rock and roll, man, you know, just a general rock and roll audience, for the time period. So like Billy Joel, his intended audience is pretty much anyone who's going to listen to him, you know, and yeah. not, and that sounds pathetic. That sounds like he's, you know, please listen to me. You know, do you want to hear a rap song? Do you want to hear disco? Right. I could do those. Yeah. But it's like he is, because piano itself is very versatile, yeah. surprisingly versatile instrument. It fits in mm-hmm. with pretty much all forms of music. It's whenever you see like somebody writing like a Broadway musical or something, it's mm-hmm. always a piano that they're at plunking away, yeah. trying to come up with. So that instrument is very much, it can serve its purpose in all these other kinds of forms of music. Right. And so he can do that. And he has toured with Elton John before. Elton John was rising up the charts in the same exact time period. Do you know if there was any kind of recognition of each other in the early days of Billy Joel's career, or was it just like, oh, there's another piano guy?
Yeah. You know, I think the, certainly like the, you know, I always go back to the Rolling Stone review of Piano Man when it came out. And, you know, there was a comparison there, not direct, but kind of, you know, making mention that, yeah, you know, there's a group of artists now that are doing this kind of work. But I think, and it should be noted too, that, I mean, that Piano Man was released like maybe 4 or 5 months after Goodbye Yellow Brick Road is released. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the idea of a piano rocker of the 1970s is certainly not, you know, people are aware of this, certainly. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, yeah, there were some comparisons. I think I've seen an interview too, where he's just, you know, kind of an early interview where he wasn't too happy about that comparison, believes he's doing different things. And you know, to kind of get back to your point a little bit, I think, you know, part of what's unique, you know, about this question of audience, you know, where the audience is. You know, if you're talking about an American audience that has become disenchanted mm-hmm. with some of the ideals in the post 1960s era, you know, the way the war had gone, the all the discussions of Watergate and what came out after that. I mean, this is in the midst of all of that.
Yeah.
And given that background, given that context, the album seems to be offering up a message that is somewhat optimistic, or perhaps even naive at its worst.
Yeah. You know?
So Travel and Prayer, for example, I mentioned that song earlier, is actually written as a prayer, right? So this idea of, you know, having faith, you know, a similar kind of celebration of, you know, so the so-called everyman in the Piano Man song, right? Here's a portrait of all the people, right? The regulars, right? Yeah. And that's where they find meaning, is in their everydayness, right? Their ability to sort of check out for a little while and have someone entertain them. Songs like Somewhere Along the Line, you know, this idea that, you know, yeah, and, you know, you don't stay young forever, you know, eventually the end, yeah, the end comes for you, you know.
Thanks, Blagel.
yeah. And, you know, if you go through all of these songs, right, there is an argument that's made there that kind of sits with what's happening in the country more generally.
Yeah.
Which is to say, of course, you know, that, you know, what we would say today, well, you know, it is what it is. You know, if Billy had just, if he'd rewritten the title of the album to be It Is What It Is, you know, maybe it'd be a different story. I don't know.
This is his second album. He doesn't want to get all super philosophical with it.
Yeah. I mean, I think, though, it's interesting because, you know, the next two albums are also commercial failures.
Yeah.
From that standpoint. And, you know, it's his last effort that, you know, makes him a household name. But I think one of the things that you see all the way up until about 1982 is sort of this reticence in the music to make some kind of a political statement, you know. And that seems to be consistent. You know, if you ever see interviews, people talk to Billy Joel, ask him about things, you know, he's been on the record as saying things like, you know, it's not the artist's place to make up some kind of a political statement of any kind, you know, and has gotten some criticism for that, seen as less serious because of a stance like that. But a sort of a darker approach to that too is this idea that maybe what we're seeing at the start of the 1970s is sort of the packaging, the distribution, the commodification of social critique vis-a-vis popular music, you know. So like, give us your political critiques, we'll make a nice album out of it, you know, and we'll, and then that's what today we call, that's your brand, you know.
Right.
Now that's, you know, an exaggerated way of saying that, you know, perhaps, you know, there's really no, there's an open question from an artifact like this, right, of what the purpose of music should be, right? And if we want it to be particularly provocative, we would say, what should the role of music be in a capitalist society?
Right. And right. If you are being rebellious in some way or counter culture or any kind of thing like that, it seems kind of surprising when you turn the album over and you see on the back Geffen Records or Capitol Records or, you know, Columbia Records in this case. Cause it's like you just said, like if you're that much of a, you know, shaking things up kind of person, you'd be going to the underground album, you know, record, you know, like Slash Records or, you know, something. Or you know, even when they started coming up with some of the more, edgier sounding names for record companies and distributions, a lot of times you'd find out it was just part of a bigger record company. It wasn't actually, you know, like as underground or as subversive as you might think.
Right.
And that's why, but I think that's the trade-off that, you know, even the most radical of musicians are willing to do, because they're like, what good is my political message if only 10 people hear it? Yeah. You know, if only the people who are gathered in this coffee house are the ones that can hear it. I'm willing to sell a little bit of my soul, perhaps, to the, you know, the cap. Like Rage Against the Machine is probably the best example I can think of. Mm-hmm. Like, they are outright communists, and yet their t-shirts, and I remember late 90s, it was like, all I came home, first day of school, I remember all these kids had Rage Against the Machine shirts on. They're all, you know, singing the songs and had the album and stuff like that. And I'm like, I think they were willing to take the hit of their cred from their fellow, you know, communists by being like, yeah, you know, we sold ourselves to whatever company distributed this, but our message is reaching suburbia. You know, our message is getting out into the high schools and that kind of thing. And, you know, be that as it's like, whatever the cost we have to hit for our reputation, so be it. Yeah. We get our music out there. Not that Billy Joel Piano Man, as we've established, is on the same par as Evil Empire, but or whatever the album is called. But, you know, it's that, you know, maybe willing to deal with the devil a little bit if you're going to get a wider audience out of it. The last question, I don't always ask this one, but given the title track especially, is this prescriptive or descriptive? Most primary sources from media, that's why I don't even bother with this most of the time, most pop culture stuff, movies, TV shows, even and especially music, are prescriptive. They want you to think a certain way or feel a certain thing. Descriptive doesn't usually sell because it's super boring if somebody's like, I was walking down the street, I saw a cat, the house is big. You know, that's not poetic. It's just boring. And I mean, there's a few songs like that. Would you put Piano Man... I think we've established that a lot of the songs are, I mean, they may have some autobiographical component to it, but it was just him kind of just throwing something against the wall, see what stuck. Mm-hmm. Would you say that the title song is at least somewhat descriptive language?
That's a great question. I think, yeah, when you put it in contrast to songs on that album, like Ain't No Crime, right? That's telling you exactly how to feel.
Yeah.
like you're totally normal. Like, it doesn't, you know, if you're mad at your significant other, you know, that's just what happens. Like, it's going to be fine. But Piano Man is another thing altogether. And I think that is, you know, a much more celebratory piece, probably. You know, so I guess the argument could be made for it being descriptive, though I have to say, you know, my tendency is to think about these things, even when they are set up that way, to ask, you know, what argument is this making?
Right.
And I think that, that a song like that, you know, tries to convey that point, you know, that, you know, it doesn't matter what walk of life, you know, you choose, it's probably going to be a dead end if not for art, if not for music,
right.
If not for being, you know, the fact that we can commiserate at the end of the day on our hopes and dreams and their, you know, failures and successes.
The setting for it may very well have been around in previous time periods and probably looked a lot different, felt a lot different than early 70s, you know, piano bar kind of thing. It was probably a lot more jazzy, you know, in the 60s and 50s yeah. and, you know, not as, because it is kind of a somber song. It's not a, you know, there's hope involved in it, but it's not as, I guess, as an English professor and as somebody who writes himself, I mean, the writing in that song is so well, it's very much show, don't tell. You know, I love how he's yeah. like, the microphone smells like a beer. He's not saying, you know, it's like you can yeah. get that, like, he totally makes you feel like you're there just right. by, you know, using really good language to make you feel where you are. But I love your interpretation also of it being like, you know, without the arts, this is, mm-hmm. I mean, people probably wouldn't congregate here. Yeah. People go to the bar all the time without live music, but this particular place, I'm the reason that they're here because they all, you know, it's like a spoken hub kind of thing.
Yeah.
That they're all attached to it. So you got through your very first, dissection of a pop culture artifact.
My goodness.
And I really appreciate you taking the time to do it. If you, as a Billy Joel fan, where would you put this album in your hierarchy? Is it, you know, towards the top? I hate doing like top tens because after number five, yeah. it's really irrelevant. But like, would you put it as most listened to, least listened to, somewhere in the middle?
That's a tough one. I certainly can't speak for, you know, what people mostly, do with this, but I would say it's comfortably somewhere in the top, three. I think there are 12 albums.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this is probably in the top three of the one that people get the most, probably because of the Piano Man song, is my guess.
Yeah. Yeah. That's kind of become his moniker too, is the Piano right. Man. So,
right. So,
which everybody else that plays piano is like, whoa.
It's just that there's so many songs. There's so many songs people don't know about on that song, on that album. And, they're certainly worth listening to.
Well, I'll say, it was nice talking to Captain Jack. I think I just came up with the title of this episode.
Right. Well, I appreciate the chat. This is a lot of fun.
Yeah, and I hope you all tune in next time to the EPS podcast, where everything, including Billy Joel's Piano Man, is a primary source. We'll talk to you next time.
I'm heading to Music City, Nashville, Tennessee, in a few weeks to take part in National Council for the Social Studies annual conference being held there. Whether or not you'll be there too, I invite you to check out my webpage, everythinghistory.com. There you'll get all of your information about this podcast, links to my social, and details about consulting and coaching services I offer. That's everything-history.com. Thanks for listening to the EPS podcast, where everything is a primary source.